Welcome to another Ethical Corporation podcast. My name is Toby Webb, and joining me today in the podcast is Timothy Deviney, who is co-author of a new book about the ethical consumer and the myth of the ethical consumer. Now, Timothy, your new book is on all about this myth of ethical consumption, published by Cambridge as of last month, I believe. So tell us a bit more about the book and why there is this myth of ethical consumption.
Well, we wrote the book basically to try and encapsulate a lot of work that we've been doing, which is really quite unique. And our work focuses more on trying to examine the relationship between what people do in their day-to-day lives and the data and the information and the surveys and all of the hype that we hear in the marketplace or in the press. And essentially, the title of the book sort of says it all in some ways, and that is that what we've really come to the conclusion about is that consumers really do not behave in the idealistic way in which it is supposed that ethical consumerism would entail. They don't really use their purchasing to make social statements. They don't really purchase uniformly in a consistent way that could be considered to be ethical by the definitions that we hear, and that a lot of the behavior itself is really driven by the nature of the environment in which the individual finds themselves, what's made available to them by the companies, and in essence what would satisfy normal things that they would do in their everyday lives.
And what about badges that have gained a lot of traction here in the UK, things like fair trade and organic?
Well, the UK is a little unique, but I think when you look at fair trade and organic, you're really looking at something where it's the availability of these products which really matter. So let me give you a really quick example of this, and that is that in the case of fair trade, it's highly unlikely that an individual is going to walk out of a coffee shop because the coffee in the coffee shop is not fair trade, even if they would know that the coffee is fair trade. It's highly unlikely that the consumer will reward a coffee manufacturer by paying a higher price for fair trade coffee. And what we've really learned in the fair trade case is that fundamentally what's happened is that proponents of the fair trade supply chain have been very good or very effective at getting coffee companies and other manufacturers to switch their supply chain to fair trade. And what the consumers are doing is the consumers are acquiescing. They're not really the drivers of the change. The change is really coming from a small group of activists who have, for whatever reason, chosen to go in that direction. And the companies themselves have reacted to this based upon the pressures from these activist groups. And where the consumers come into it is consumers come into it and sort of said, yeah, okay, that's fine. You know, we accept it as long as the coffee tastes good. But the consumers aren't the driver. The consumers are simply acquiescing to what the companies and the activists have pushed through the supply chain.
So you say in the book that function really counts. Just talk us through that a bit more. You're saying that they don't expect extra, but they want it to be the same as before and the same price. I mean, what's your view there?
I think that there are two things associated with that. One is that we ran a series of experiments where individuals basically had to trade off functionality versus ethics. And what we found is that in circumstances in which kind of the ethical side was in conflict with the functional side of the product, in other words, the functional side being the things that people expect naturally from that product, that functionality invariably trumps the ethics. In other words, when people have to take something off the table, they will take off the social components of the product. But that statement is actually a little bit more complex. What it means is that when you're looking at trying to provide products with a social component attached to them, you can't do that independent of the way in which people make decisions. In other words, people have spent a very long period of time learning how to be kind of habitual consumers. They've spent a very long period of time learning kind of their own optimal or reasonable decision rules for the way in which they shop. And then to kind of try and bolt onto that a social component just simply doesn't work. In other words, if you can't integrate the social components into the decision-making process of the consumer, it's simply going to be a foreign body and the individuals are going to ignore it. If over time you can convince them that the social components matter, yeah, it might work. And there are examples where that is in fact work. And in the fair trade case, that's a good example as well. And that is that individuals have not revolted against fair trade. They've simply acquiesced to it. Because it's consistent with the decision-making process. In other words, the fair trade coffee doesn't taste worse. Yeah, it's just simply sourced in a different way. And as long as individuals feel that that's okay, then it fits with their decision-making model. They still go in the morning and buy the coffee.
So what's your assessment of the successes of ethical consumer marketing? Is it just in those niche brands, which then inevitably seem to get bought up by the big boys?
In essence, if you focus on products which are labeled as ethical, then the answer is that will always be a niche. That will never be a mass market phenomenon. And the reason it'll never be a mass market phenomenon is simply because individuals don't buy products for singular reasons. They buy products for very complex, heterogeneous kind of reasons. And that you could convince people that the social components matter, but they're only going to be one of many. So when individuals, let's say, buy a hybrid car, they don't buy a hybrid car because the car is a hybrid. They buy a hybrid car because it has all sorts of other components that matter to them. And the hybrid is only one minor component of this. When individuals, let's say, purchase products which might have degrees of energy efficiency in their appliances, that is only one minor part of a very complex process. And you can't ignore the fact that this is only one minor part. It's a much more complex phenomenon. It's very idiosyncratic to the nature of the products that the individual purchases, and it's very idiosyncratic to the nature of the individuals who do the purchasing.
So because context is so important, and because there are so many inputs into the decision-making, I suppose would you say that the ethical consumer as a large or even a medium-sized group just can't ever really exist because it's impossible to pin down that one variable? That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes. In some sense, if we're highly critical in the book, we're highly critical about what I would call the breathless press releases associated with numbers like 70% of consumers say they will boycott a product if it was made by in a certain way, or made by children, or environmentally damaging. And the answer is, very simply, that's nonsense. If that was the case, then we would expect this enormous wave of purchasing behavior associated with that, and corporations would be falling over themselves to provide these types of products. So the reality is really much different than that. The reality is one where when you go and you ask an individual in a survey, you know, would you willingly purchase products that were made by children in less developed countries? Well, they have an incentive to say, of course not, I would never do that. But when you go to them and you, let's say, provide them with a mixture of products which potentially might have that as one of the minor benefits, in some circumstances that will resonate with them, but in another set of circumstances that might not resonate with them. So you have to really look at this on a kind of product category by product category basis, issue by issue basis. And you can't make gross generalization statements about the nature of the way in which individuals behave. It simply doesn't work.
So if I put it to you, there's been far too much corporate focus on the ethical consumer, which has disadvantage the sort of mainstreaming of ethics and sustainability into products and life cycle analysis and environmental footprinting of products. Would you say that was a true statement?
I would actually say it isn't the corporations that are at issue. I think that part of the problem is I think it's a much more complex problem than that. Part of it is related to the fact that the way in which companies historically create their products doesn't work as well with respect to products where there's a social component to it. So companies will naturally go out, they'll do focus groups, they'll do surveys, they'll do other things. And for the functional aspects of products, people will tell them the truth. They will give information that the companies can use to build new products. But in the case of social context or social situations, social components of products, individuals don't have an incentive to actually tell you what it is that they would really do in specific types of circumstances. So in those cases, what you find that the companies, in some sense, are equally duped by bad data, bad methods, and other things. And many companies have gone on thinking that what they could do is they could survey consumers, do focus groups, do other things, and then build ethical products. And what they find is they find that those numbers never add up, And the reason they never add up is that they need very different types of market research and very different, a different way of understanding their own consumers.
We've certainly always argued that the ethical consumer was always going to be a tiny part of an ABC1 category, or however one wants to look at a certain demographic that will buy certain products at a price premium or go out of their way to pick something off the shelf. And we've suggested for many years in the magazine that companies just need to get on with this because their consumers just expect them to manage these issues. Does that tally with your research? In terms of, I'm talking about sustainability, their carbon footprint, minimising water use, labour standards, etc.
Generally speaking, yes. The key in some sense is if you're able to provide a product which has an additional social benefit, individuals will accept that benefit when it's put onto the table to them. But if you turn around and you expect them to pay up front for that benefit, then you tend to get resistance. And so what you find that the best companies, the companies that we've seen which have really done things well, have essentially thought about this in a more sophisticated way, relating back to the nature of the way in which individuals make purchasing decisions. One of my favorites is a company that builds houses. And what they found is they found that they would build these housing estates, and they had all of these additional regulatory requirements about energy usage, cogeneration of power on site, water utilization. And what they found is they found that if they went and attempted to force the consumer, the house purchaser, to pay for these things, they got resistance. And there's a lot of reasons why they got the resistance they got. But the fundamental reason was that the individuals could buy a house of a certain configuration inside the housing estate, or they could go outside and buy an older built house which didn't have these additional costs and get a house configured basically the same way. And they'd say, well, why should we pay for all these additional bells and whistles? And when we are really uncertain as to what the benefit is to us from these. And what this company did was they were very sophisticated in the way in which they changed the contract that was offered to the individuals. So rather than having the individuals own all the environmental components of their homes, they actually embedded it in the governance system of the body corporate of the local area. And then they rented the use of the individual's house for the generation of power, which they put back onto the grid. And so they changed the nature of the way they were structuring things in a way that, in fact, didn't impose any burdens on the individuals, but allowed them to be able to sell the products that they were selling. So they were really sophisticated in trying to ask the question, how do we coax people into understanding the benefits of what it is that we're doing, but doing it in a competitive market where they could walk outside, and buy a product that was competing with us, which didn't have these attributes.
So that was about finding an innovative way of looking at things in a slightly perhaps longer term payback situation.
Yeah, I think that if you look at companies that are smart about this, they do a couple things. One is that they think about the nature of the decision model that individuals have. So, for example, one of the things that we discovered in that housing example was that the biggest thing that was stopping people by buying energy efficient houses was technology resistance. In other words, they had a resistance to the technology because they knew that they weren't going to own the house for their lives, but only a short period of time. And if they were going to sell the house in 5 to 7 years, the technology in which they were being asked to invest today would be obsolete in 7 years, and they'd have to retrofit the houses. So the first thing is to understand the nature of the decision-making process of the individual. But then the second part of it is to understand that what you're really doing with these types of products, whether they're sustainability issues or ethical issues or organics, is you're actually engaging in an innovation process. And all innovation processes require the purchasers to be, I wouldn't say educated, but they have to be coaxed to understand the nature of the benefit of the thing that they're getting. Nobody was sitting there saying, we want PCs, right? The PCs were developed, and then they, over time, adapted to the consumer. Nobody was saying, we want a Windows operating system. Nobody was saying, we want a mobile phone. Nobody was saying, we want an iPhone. Nobody was saying, we want an iPod. right? You know, that all of these things were things that the companies themselves put onto the markets as part of their innovation process. But that's only part of the process. Part of the process requires you to develop the product, but also get the individuals to understand that the use of that product makes their lives better off.
Lots of companies are now starting to find that the long-term footprint of their product is in usage and disposal at the consumer end.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously not in some sectors, but say in fast-moving consumer goods, for example. I have heard some chief executives begin to talk about a model that was mooted in the car industry years ago, which is now starting to come back with electric vehicles, of rather than selling people products, leasing them those products or providing them with services, and those products can then be returned with an incentive for recycling and end-of-life use. Do you see that as a major trend in the next 5 or 10 years, or is it going to take longer?
Well, that's an interesting one, because that housing example that I gave you before was one of those examples. So rather than trying to get an individual to put solar panels on their roof, rather than trying to get them to have this energy-efficient technology in their house, and so you have everybody owning it, what they did is they said, what we'll do is we'll own the technology. And what we will do is we'll rent your roof space.
Yeah.
Okay. And we'll lease you the usage of your white goods. So I think there is that, but also and that will work in certain societies better than others because they're used to that model. Okay. So but again, it comes down to the decision model. When you're sort of trying to get people to think about, let's say, car sharing, when you're trying to get them to think about leasing their automobile rather than buying their automobile, or leasing their white goods, which I think has arisen in a number of places, it goes back to the decision model. You're getting people to change the decision model. So
the
what you have to do, you have to well, you have to convince them that you know it's a better model for them. You know that's the way that it occurs. Now you can see this with the iPod, and that was a model that Apple came up with, which not only included the technology, but the software plus the suppliers in the system, so that individuals will now rent songs buy songs one by one, okay, or lease movies, right, so that they can watch them. Okay, all of those things, in fact, are things which have changed the nature of the behavior of some individuals. Now, it may also be that there are some individuals who will never change their behavior. So that what you simply have to do if they're older individuals, you just simply have to wait them out. So what you do is you work on changing the purchasing habits or the decision models of younger people, and then you wait a generation until that flows through the system, and then everybody's kind of doing it. So everybody wears seatbelts. People will recycle their garbage. They will do things which are take a generation to work their way through the system. So I think you have to really look on it as a much longer term thing where the companies are engaging in this innovation. Some of these innovations are going to stick. Some of them aren't going to stick. Some of them are going to be niche. Some may be a bit more mainline. Some may be picked up by the regulators. So in the case of automobiles and other areas of sustainability, those things are being picked up by the regulators. You know, once you start getting carbon trading, once you start getting other types of regulatory structures in place, ultimately those things will work their way down through the society.
Isn't there a big psychological barrier to overcome with leasing your white goods? When people buy things, they feel momentarily better about life themselves. They like to own things. They like to own property. They like to own their cars. Do we not have a big psychological barrier to break through by saying to people, you don't need to own this, it's better for the environment if you don't own it, and you can have an incentive to return it and it doesn't end up in landfill? But isn't that quite a difficult leap for us to make, when we've been brought up since World War II on prosperity and buying our own things?
Again, it depends on the society in which you find yourself. When I was growing up as a child, you would want to own your car. You know, that you'd want to possess those things. And the vast majority of Americans lease automobiles. And the leasing model has some advantages to it in terms of the nature of the way in which it can be used. It really depends on the nature of the society and how the society itself is operating. And also what some of the financial incentives are associated with it. And in the case of, say, the recycling aspects, you may really want to go through a leasing model. And that model may, in fact, be financially really quite quite effective, because it individuals would say have a cost of purchasing which has a downstream cost to them when they ultimately must get rid of that product, whereas the manufacturer may be able to come in with a lower total price for this entire set of services. And there have been examples of that. Ted Levitt, back in the 1960s, wrote a quite famous article on globalization in Harvard Business Review, where he talked about the fact that standardization would overwhelm the heterogeneity in global markets because the economies of scale were so large that the price between a kind of standardized product and a more culturally adapted product were going to be so large that people were just going to look at the difference and go with the standardized product. Now, that hasn't been true, but there are many examples where companies have standardized their product offerings because they could offer 50-60% discounts with the standardized offering. And what they found that's a big number, and people will react to that number. But it takes time. This is not a kind of 1 year thing, 2 year thing. You know, you have to remember that the internet took 10-15 years to kick off. You know, PCs took 25 years to kick off. Mobile phones took even longer, in fact, if you looked at the numbers.
Okay. Timothy, thank you very much for your time today. It's been great speaking with you. You've been listening to a podcast with me, Toby Webb, and Timothy Devinney, author of the new book, The Myth of the Ethical Consumer. And if you want to get more information about the book, which is published by Cambridge, you can go to www.mythoftheethicalconsumer.com. So that brings us to the end of this podcast. Please do check back to the website for more podcasts soon. You can also find us on iTunes by searching for Ethical Corporation. Thank you. Great.